The Rock and Roll Coffee Show is brought to you by Writers and Rockers Coffee Company, keeping the music and memories alive with some damn good coffee. Be sure to pick up your Rock and Roll Coffee Show coffee only at writersandrockerscoffee.com. And also brought to you by Retroactive, located at Broadway at the Beach in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, keeping you retro with everything from 70s, 80s, and 90s. ShopRetroactive.com. How are you, bud?
I'm good. Hanging in there. I got my birthday coming up on Halloween.
On Halloween?
Yeah.
Halloween, baby. Happy birthday.
Yep. Thank you.
Does that have something to do with your horror interest?
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, I just definitely like always embraced Halloween and literally one of the best birthdays of the year, you know, until now that I have kids and now it's like more about them, but like sure. Over the years, like as far as I mean, we had some great Jet Boy shows that we did on Halloween. I remember we did one at the on Broadway in San Francisco with Poison. They opened for us and I remember it was a super crazy one, like that wound up with, because we had jack-o'-lanterns carved all over the stage and they wound up getting smashed and thrown everywhere. Like, it was a good one.
That sounds like fun. I bet the club owner liked that one, cleaning up after.
Yeah, I mean, we were you know, that was our scene, that was our family, you know, so yeah. That was kind of okay, you know. It was a pretty punk rock club. Oh, here comes my cat. I was like, my door opens. No, not the kids this time.
Just the cat.
What was this? But yeah, definitely always embrace horror movies, really the creature side of things, the special effects, you know.
Yeah. I saw something. What is that top horror? I saw your pictures on their social media and stuff. Is that something that's yours or what is that?
No, Top Stone is Yeah, so it's the owners of Don Juan Grooming Products, the company I work for. That's one of their other brands that they do, and it's based on the original Top Stone latex masks that they came out with. You know, the company started in the late or mid 40s and went through the 60s and 70s, but they're kind of known for being the first ones to introduce the full latex mask for Halloween costumes to the industry. And yeah, they purchased the trademark a couple of years ago and they're putting out some cool stuff.
Yeah, so I just followed them.
I had my psychobilly band, my horror band. In fact, I'm wearing the shirt now, Cold Blue Rebels.
Yeah.
You can see it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's awesome.
And that was like a horror themed, you know, zombie go-go dancers and coffins on stage and stuff like that. Yeah, but I've always, I mean, my wife and I actually went to a Stephen King It themed escape room last night.
Yes. How was that?
It was good. It was really good. Part two was last night. Last Wednesday, we did part one. Highly recommend it. They did a great job with all the sets and rooms. I mean, it's like you felt like you were in the movie, in the sewers, and all the sets that they made were really cool. So good time.
Did you get out?
Yeah, you know, they're kind of, they do have people in each room and they kind of give you hints here and there. There's a lot of rooms, so if you make the time limit, I think you get like a clue for the next room. If you don't, you just move on to the next room. So
yeah, that sounds fun. I would love to do something like that. I've never even done an escape room, but
yeah, this is my first time.
An it themed one's fantastic.
There's a Saw one. There's like a bunch of ones, you know. Yeah, I think they have a Blair Witch one here as well that's going on right now. Oh, man. A lot of stuff going on in Vegas at Halloween time. So
yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about you and your career and Jet Boy and what's going on. I've been a Jet Boy fan for a while. I saw you guys in 88, I want to say it was, opening for Striper. And I still have, look at this, found this guy.
Wow, yeah. So, like, two cool things, right? So that Striper tour was, I want to say it was either our first or second tour. I know we did a tour with Kix, and we did a tour with Striper. Striper, I think, was kind of like our first big kind of, you know, large theater, small arena tour. So that's pretty cool that you caught us on that tour. And then that t-shirt, you know, I mean, God, that such a limited edition run of those, you know what I mean? Like, this wasn't back at a time where we were doing thousands of shirts. I mean, we did, you know, something like that. There was like, you know, a couple hundred or whatever, you know what I mean? So,
the cool thing to do back then too was cut the sleeves off. So unfortunately I cut the sleeves off.
Cut the collars off, sleeves off, you know, down the sides.
And a little story about this. I think Fernie signed this and I think Ron signed this. Now, here's what happened with them. So this was in Lakeland, Florida. Okay. Where I saw you guys, it was in a arena. We used to go early to the shows, you know, we always want to try and meet the band. So we went down there and Striper was actually signing autographs at a Kmart that day.
Okay.
So we went and did that. And then we went to the arena. So we were hanging out by the fence, by the buses, and Fernie and Ron came out and started talking to us. And they really wanted to see some alligators. There was like a little lake right there. I guess they had never seen alligators or something at the time.
Well, at that time too, I've always been the reptile collector in the band. And at that time, right when I joined Jet Boy, I was living with my friend I'm still good friends with, and eventually my roommate, Mitch White, who had all kinds of reptiles and stuff. So they were acquainted with them, but definitely like when we got into the South, you know, we were all about like, let's see some freaking alligators and snakes and cool stuff.
Yeah. That's what I remember. We didn't see any, there was a pond there and stuff, but we didn't see any, but I remember them wanting to find some alligators. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
I don't remember how I got this signed though. I must've found them after the show too or something. Cause I got this in the venue, I think.
But, right.
Yeah. Good times.
Yeah, well, it was that time, right? I mean, we were looking to connect with people, and so we were easily accessible, right? We weren't rock starring out or anything, and came up to the bus, we were always like, hey, what's up? Let's party. Usually looking for weed and other things as well, you know.
Yeah. Were you guys a big party band?
You know, I wouldn't say so in light of, you know, some of the stuff like Motley Crue and Nikki Sixx and the Heroin Diaries. And, you know, we were, but we weren't as extreme as some. I was probably the most extreme one because I did, you know, experiment with needles and heroin and some of the more extreme stuff, but never to, you know, never to an extreme extent. Our bass player, obviously our original bass player, Todd Crew, eventually died from a heroin overdose. And we were all kind of playing with that fire then, but we were pretty good, you know. We always had weed on the bus, you know, and we had our fun. But, you know, when I look back in comparison to a lot of other bands, we were not too insane.
How was the Striper tour? Was that?
It was cool. You know, I mean, it was odd for us. And I didn't really know too much about them other than they were a Christian band. The guys were super cool, very nice and cordial, and we got along fine. That's about it. You know, I feel like one thing that stands out in my mind was like seeing the crowd, and they had these little Bibles that they would throw out in the crowd at some point. And it was shocking to me that most of the kids took them and ripped them up and threw the pages in the air. And I'm like, aren't you here because they're a Christian band? But it was kind of that way. Like a lot of their fans were just into the metal music and not necessarily like, you know, there for the Christian aspect. So nice guys for sure.
Let's go back to, you grew up in New Jersey, right?
Yeah.
And then went to California when you were around 15, if I recall.
Yep. I moved to South Bay, Santa Clara when I was 15. My dad was in the electronics industry. He was in the advertising side of things, but it was right when the Silicon Valley started to explode. And yeah, we came out right around that time. And
were you into music before you went out there, or did you get into music once you got out there?
Yeah, I started playing drums. You know, I was always kind of in concert band and, you know, dabbled in this and that, but I was too hyper, too ADHD to like focus on learning a set instrument. But I did start taking drum lessons when I was probably, I don't know, 10 years old or so. I wanted a drum set, and my parents were like, look, take drum lessons for a year and then we'll get you a drum set. And I did, and they got me the drum set. So I was doing that. And when, you know, when I started to make friends that were musicians in high school in California, I started, you know, jamming with friends in the garage, you know. My good friend that I'm still friends with, one of my few high school friends I'm still friends with, Jeff Pareda, he played guitar. And he would like, he had like a stereo amp, you know, just like a radio dial, you know, and he would bring it over and he like wired it something in the back where he could like plug in his guitar and play through the stereo. And we would jam out in my garage. And that's kind of when I started singing, because there was just two of us, right? So he played and I played drums and I started singing. And
Playing drums?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that's when I first started to kind of realize I mean, as far back as I can remember, when I was a toddler, I was always singing. You know, I was like annoyingly singing everything. I was singing all the time. You know, singing toy commercials and cartoon songs and jingles and whatnot, right?
Yeah.
But that was really the first time I think, you know, people were like, wow, you have a really good voice, you know? And I was like trying to be a drummer and play Neil Peart stuff, you know? And I was like, well, what about my drumming? And they were like, well, you've got a really good voice. You know? I also sang a little bit in church choir, like, but, you know, like first, second, third grade, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's kind of where I started to find my voice and figure things out there. I remember singing songs like The Babies came out head first, if you remember that song. I remember singing that one and playing drums. And of course, the Zeppelin stuff. And yeah, just like stuff that was on the radio, Journey and stuff like that, you know.
Was Jet Boy your first band that you really were like the front man singer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, no, actually it wasn't. There's another band that I was in called Sweet Evil.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first band. That was with some of my high school friends. It was more of a Black Sabbath meets Motley Crue kind of sounding band and style band. Yeah, so that Sweet Evil was really the first band. And then actually before Sweet Evil, I was in the punk rock scene. So between that kind of high school jamming, you know, stuff when I was like 15 or so, and then, you know, when I got up to be like 17, 18, 19, I started getting into the punk scene and I played drums and, you know, jamming with friends and whatnot and did a little bit of singing, but nothing that we ever gigged out. And then that led me to kind of like, you know, Motley Crue and Motorhead and bands that I started discovering there, except, right, I started getting into that, like, you know, English metal and British metal. And then Sweet Evil happened for a short period, and that led me to Jet Boy. I think I met Todd because our girlfriend, we were dating two girls that were friends. And he was like, you know, oh, you know, I'm jamming with this band. We need a singer. And I was like, oh, I'm jamming with this band and we need a bass player. So like he came and auditioned for Sweet Evil and I went and auditioned for Jet Boy. And then it was kind of like, you know, that was that, you know.
Jet Boy was the better of the two.
Yeah, because I had already started discovering, you know, getting into the glam bands and kind of evolving from that, you know, kind of punk into like British metal. And then I was like, oh, glam rock and, you know, the New York Dolls and stuff like that. And man, it's when I think about it, it happened so fast. I mean, it was like a 5 or 6 year period that I just went through all these major changes. And then
did you have the mohawk when you joined Jet Boy or did you get that after?
No, I just had the messy hair
teased out.
But it happened after the first, I mean, definitely probably within the first 6 months of being in Jet Boy.
What made you decide to do that?
Probably my girlfriend at the time. You know, she was like kind of like a goth death rock girl, you know, and you know, all of my girlfriends and even my wife to this day have influence on how I dress and whatnot, you know. But yeah, probably it was her suggestion. I think she was actually in like beauty school at that point too. Because I remember we were like dyeing my hair crazy colors and stuff pretty regularly as well.
Yeah, because that's a pretty bold move to come into a rock band at that time and shave your head.
For us, it didn't because the scene that was happening in San Francisco and Broadway, right? The North Beach Broadway scene where you had the Stone and the On Broadway and the Bab. And, you know, that was really like the Sunset Strip for San Francisco on a smaller level. But and it was just much more because San Francisco is small, right? It's like 7 square miles. It's not like L.A., where you've got, you know, Orange County and East LA and West LA and Hollywood and all these areas. I mean, it's like, so you had, you know, just kind of everything pushed together in a small space, meaning like punk rock and metal and, you know, glam rock and like everything that was happening, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And we had such a diverse audience, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, and we didn't have, or at least I didn't have illusions of grandeur in the beginning. I was just doing it for fun and
having a blast.
Do my thing. It wasn't like, you know, yeah, I want to get signed. You know, we were, you know, for Billy and Fern and the guitar players who really started the band were much more, you know, educated on everything and, you know, had a plan intact, but for me, it was just like, you know, I don't know. It was never really questioned. I mean, it was, right? Like you're right. It was a bold move, but it was like, it wasn't like, oh shit, man, what if this doesn't work? It was just like, oh, fuck, go for it. I mean, every time I went out on stage with some crazy freaking, you know, stockings and high heels and a thong or whatever, chaps, you know, with my ass hanging out or whatever, like every move was kind of bold and, you know, out there, but that's what made it cool, you know.
I loved it. I remember seeing you guys, I think it was on Headbangers Ball when I first saw you guys, and I was like, what is that? What's he got a mohawk, you know? So it drew my attention to it, and then I watched it and then liked it.
And I mean, that, you know, but by that time we were already in the system, you know. We had an album and we're like rubbing shoulders with, you know, the rich and famous, you know, rock stars, and we're custom made clothes and stuff, you know what I mean? But like in the beginning, you know, those first 5 years, it was like, you know, we made all our own clothes, we did our own makeup, we just, you know what I mean? That, to me, that was like the really cool era of like, you know, before it kind of became commercialized, right? And then it blew up and it was like all these bands, you know,
Now you guys, you were like, you had San Francisco, right? You were, you had it.
And when we started coming to LA, we made friends with all the hot bands at that time, Guns N' Roses, You know, or maybe it was even Hollywood Rose at first, and Poison, and you know, we came down and got gigs with them and opened or supported them, and then we would bring them up to San Francisco because we knew all the promoters, and I mean we played every show that came to San Francisco, and I don't care who it was, if it was fucking the Toy Dolls from England or fucking Bo Diddley. You know, we fucking opened, we wanted to open for Bo Diddley. We got it because we knew the whole Keystone family. We were like, we were the band that they knew were going to fucking fill the club no matter what. And so any artist that came to San Francisco, and it wound up with us having a really diverse, you know, level of bands that we played with, right? But yeah, we brought, you know, we would bring the LA bands up and they would open for us or support us. And there'd be, you know, two or three openers, and then we would go to LA and support them. And, we really helped each other out that way, you know,
mm-hmm. Did you guys sign your time, deal? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, by the time we got a manager and started getting record label attention, obviously the first thing was like, well, you guys got to move to LA, cause that's where everything is. And like, sure, you can do it from here, but it's going to be much easier to get more record label people to come out and see you if you're in LA. So then we started our migration.
I see.
South.
Yeah. I was going to ask why you chose to go to LA, but you just answered that. So,
yeah, I mean, it wasn't really our choice. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. I would have preferred to stay in San Fran, but you know, I get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're like, what, much more productive, and you've got meetings at management companies and publishing companies and whatever, and it just made everything easier. So
mm-hmm. Now Todd was still with you guys when you went to LA, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then soon afterwards though, you released him, right?
So yeah, you know, like at that point, it was right during when things started to get serious. And I believe we had signed already with Elektra Records. We were meeting with possible producers. And I remember we met with Paul Stanley from Kiss. Like we were meeting with, you know, to figure out who was going to produce the record. And, you know, just, it was really like a lot of meetings with our music attorney and meetings at the record label and whatnot. And, you know, he was just, that's when it became apparent that he really was like, mm-hmm. you know, going downhill, you know what I mean? Because it was like, he couldn't, you know, it's just like, all right, dude, we have a meeting at 9 a.m. Like, just be fucking sober and, you know, be on time and don't disappear and like shit, you know, and afterwards all good. And then it would be like, you know, where's Todd? You know, I don't know. He didn't come home last night. And we got to track him down. And like, you know, got to be like, you know, the management and everybody's getting pissed off, you know, fuck this guy, you know, like, and then it was, you know, I mean, I remember him like falling over, like in rehearsal, like literally like passing out and falling over like in the middle of a song. And, you know, you're like, okay, well, it's not live on stage, but you know, you're like, come on, man,
it could be.
You're right. Exactly. And that's all we had to do. Like, we didn't have jobs. We got record company advance money. We got set up in a couple apartments. It wasn't lush by any mean. I mean, it was like a fucking mattress on the floor or whatever, you know? But you know, all we had to do was like, write songs. And I mean, when I think back of it now, I'm like, oh my God, it's like the dream. Like, you're just music, going and recording demos, like going to meetings, going to parties, like whatever. You know, he was not handling where he was at. We tried to involve his parents and we got him in a rehab, which he left immediately. He was really like chumming up to the Guns N' Roses guys, who we were all friends with, right? But he was starting to be like more hanging out at their house than with us.
Probably not the best place for him.
Yeah, right, exactly. And none of us do, you know what I mean? There was animosity back in the day, but I don't harbor any, and I don't think those guys do either. We all were playing with fire, and it, you don't know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Just think, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
don't know each person's level of what they can handle or what they can't. Mm-hmm. And he clearly was one of those addictive personality people who wasn't handling it, got out of hand really fast. And that, you know, again, you got people in your ear going like, you know, this is your guy's one big chance and you can't blow it. And like, you know,
how did he take it when you had to do that?
Horribly. Oh, I mean, it was hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think within like, you know, within 3 or 4 weeks, I remember seeing him out at one of the many clubs we hung out with. It could have been Cat House or White Trash A Go-Go or any one of those. And he just had like a big grizzly beard and he just looked horrible. And this was out of time, right? This is glam rock peak, right? You know, pink rouge and lip gloss. And this guy's got like a grizzly beard and he was just like greasy and, you know, was just like, oh my God, man. Yeah, I mean, I wish I could go back and do it another way because it killed him. You know what I mean? It's like, he was just stripped of everything that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
you don't know at that time. You don't.
Yeah, you don't know exactly.
But,
yeah.
So then you guys, we can go on to, you got his replacement was Sammy, right?
Yep, Sammy. Yep. And we had hosted auditions and had a bunch of people come out. It's funny because I remember Mike Roach from TSOL, who I know still. In fact, I just saw him a few weeks back at the Punk Rock Museum. We did a tour there and he was our tour guide and we were talking old punk rock day stories. But I remember it was during that period, if you remember, when TSOL was like going for like the rock thing. And I remember him auditioning for us but of course it was like, you know, I remember our management going like, you know, well, if you could pick anyone, who would you pick? And it was like, well, Sammy Hoffa from How They Rocks, because that was shortly after Razzle, their drummer, had died with Vince Neil, and the band disbanded, and was like, shit, he might be available. And they were like, you know, you got record company people. All right, we'll track him down and fucking make him an offer. And I think it was timing for him, you know.
He wasn't in the States, right?
Or was he was in Finland or Spain or something, you know. But yeah, I mean, I don't think he needed to hear too much other than, you know, I mean, he heard our music, of course, you know. I'm not going to say he was. You know, I'm sure if you ask him this day, I mean, I think he was, the whole thing had appeal for him, of course, but we were signed to a label. It was like, come on, fly over, you know, and we got along great right off the bat, you know, and we literally shared a studio apartment. Me and Billy and Sammy shared a studio with 3 mattresses on the floor. And, you know, we ate chicken quesadillas with hot sauce. And
that's
like,
all you need at that point in your life, right?
By with like $50 a week for like food and expenses. Our rent and bills were paid, but we didn't have a lot to live on.
Yeah.
But we got along great, you know.
And then shortly after that is when you signed with Elektra? Already signed with them?
We had already signed with Elektra. And then, so Sam came over, we did all our pre-production, we recorded Feel the Shake. And then literally like days before the release date of Feel the Shake, Elektra, which was an East Coast based label, fired the entire West Coast offices,
mm-hmm.
the president on down, including our, A&R guy, Steve Pross. And it was just like that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's where I first learned the term shelf. They shelved you guys, you know. It's like, what the fuck does that mean? But you know, we had obviously we had other record label interests, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was I don't know what their deal was, like why they, you know, I just think it was they didn't they lost faith in the West Coast office staff. Maybe, I don't know. And they just
yeah, that's odd. When was this?
Figure out what was what, you know.
87, 88, around there?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so everything was still kicking out there.
And then, you know, it didn't take too long. We had meetings with, I think, Warner Brothers, Geffen, MCA. MCA came in with the strongest offer. They all wanted us to record an album for them, you know, and we're like, we just recorded our first album, you know. They were like, well, you know, we want to, you know, re-record it or work on some new songs or whatever. And we're like, meanwhile, Guns N' Roses and all these other bands are getting on tour with Aerosmith, and they're like, you know, they're on their way. And we're like, what? It's just put it out and let us go, man. Like, we're in every fucking rock magazine, you know.
Is that what came out? I have it right here, actually.
Yeah, Feel the Shake was actually recorded under Elektra, but it came out on MCA.
Yeah, this is MCA.
And it took close to a year, or about a year, for all the negotiations to go through and the contracts. So we literally lost like an entire year where the record was done. And by the time it came out, like a year went by.
Mm. Would it have been different if you re-recorded? Would you have been out sooner or no?
Yeah, not, you know, right? No way. It would have been longer. Mm. It would have been longer because we would have had to, you know, even if they said, okay, you know, the songs are great, just go in and re-record them. You know, and then remember, like with a major label release, it's like they need a 6-month lead time allotted for release, right? They need to have all their press lined up. They have to have all their radio station stuff lined up. Like it's a process, you know? So really what took the longest was just going back and forth with the record contract. That probably took 6 months, and then they slotted it for release 6 months later, which was the fastest they could get it all together, you know?
Yeah. Looking back on it, do you think MCA was the right choice for you guys?
You know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Well, look, after Feel the Shake came out, we toured for a little bit. They pulled us off the road and said, you know, we want you to do, you know, your second album. And then literally the same thing happened again, because the record had just been out like a couple of months and we were on tour, and then Sony Music came in and bought MCA Universal. Like, it was one of those huge takeovers, and the same thing. It was just like, they shelved everything. We came off the road, we show up at the record label, and it's like empty fucking desks, you know? And you're like, the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know if it would have made a difference. Within a year after that, the whole thing died, you mm-hmm. know, for the most part, right?
Yeah.
It was all about, they were signing Nirvana and all these other bands. And
you guys had a great second record, though. Good record.
The evolution was great. And I think the record we put out 3 years ago or 4 years ago in 2019, Born to Fly to me is the perfect, you know, I mean, yeah. I'm not, you know, I know it's years went by and we're a lot older, but I really feel like it's the exact progression from Damnation.
Yeah, good stuff. There was a record you had out. I think it was like a compilation. It was called A Day
in the Glamorous Life. Yeah.
All like demos and stuff?
Yeah. Yep. Unreleased stuff, you know, demos of stuff that didn't make it to the records, and then demo versions of some songs like Feel the Shake and Heavy Chevy. There's three, actually. There's Make Some More Noise, and then there's A Day in the Glamorous Life. And then there's one more for rock and roll. And then we also put out in about 2007, we put out Off Your Rocker, mm-hmm. which was like a 3-song EP with 2 live tracks from the M3 Festival.
Mm-hmm. The reason I was asking, because there's some songs on that A Day in the...
Yeah.
That one. that are really good. I'm like, man, yeah, these should have been on some records.
Yeah. I know. Well, that was the thing, right? I mean, I remember like when we did Damnation, it was like they wanted us to have like 30 to 40 songs to select from. And they paid for the studio time. So it was just like, all right, let's write more songs, you know? And then we'd write more songs, like, all right, we like some of these, write some more, you know? And it was a huge amount of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. So we're about what, into the grunge era now. And then you guys called it quits and around the mid 90s.
Well, yeah, when we got dropped from MCA, that was it. It was done. Like we had no money. When the record company money goes away, now, well, how are you going to pay your rent and stuff? And we weren't all about like, you know, oh, go get a job down at the coffee shop or whatever, you know what I mean? So we chose to move back to the Bay Area. We all kind of like stayed with friends and family for a while. We regrouped. We got a new manager, Bill Graham, management company took us on, and the manager went off to work trying to get us another record deal, and it was just nobody wanted it, you know what I mean? They just, you know, Jet Boy was old news by then already, you know.
So I mean, I'm trying to put myself in your situation, because when you're in Jet Boy, I'm thinking as myself, as a teenager, 20-year-old, you know, I thought, okay, yeah, I'm going to be in a rock band. That's all that I was focused on, right? I thought it was just going to happen. It never really semi-happened, but never really did, like your status, right?
Right.
So when you're out there on tour with Striper and Kix and stuff, are you thinking like, this is it, we did it? And are you not thinking it's going to end at a point, or what was your thought process?
Right, because this is, you know, you even though we had all these people in our ears and lawyers and managers advising us, but you don't really understand that the way record deals work, like, you know, you pick up the high points, like, oh, we signed a 20 album record deal, you know, and it's like, well, that's 20 albums if you're successful every time and we want to keep you on the label. Like, it's seldom like you get a fucking Rolling Stones that like puts out 20 albums, or even ones that do, it's usually not the same label, but you know, so you're not really thinking or worrying about it suddenly coming to an end. Although I think we probably were a little gun shy with what happened at Elektra, but when it happened again with MCA, I mean, no, we didn't give up, you know, we regrouped. Eventually we got back into San Francisco, we got apartments, we got jobs, and we kept writing music. And then when it seemed like we couldn't get a deal as Jet Boy, we changed. I mean, Sammy bailed, right? Our original drummer, Ron Tostenson, bailed. So we got another drummer, we got another bass player. And then it's like, well, our sound started evolving and getting heavier and heavier. And so we're like, why don't we just change the name and, you know, try to start fresh. So that's when we changed the name from Jet Boy to Mind Zone. And we just took that path that was closer to like Metallica and Pantera. And, you know, again, you know, we came so close to just, we even had a couple record deals. We had a record deal with a German label that like we had signed the deal, and then all of a sudden they went out of business, and like it was kind of a tumultuous time in the industry. Napster started happening, people were freaking out, you know. Yeah, I mean, it really wasn't until the first revolution in what we now refer to as the hair metal scene, right around 2005 or six, when it had been long enough where it started making its first comeback. And that's when we reunited and you know, started doing it again. And we kind of stayed at it since then for the most part, you know.
You stepped away in what, 2010 or something? Didn't you step away?
Yeah, that was a, you know, I don't want to go too into that, but it was just, it was a tumultuous time. I didn't get along with the manager we had. They wanted to do a tour in Europe. We had never toured Europe. It wasn't going to be profitable. I had a good job working at Lip Service Clothing, like the coolest rock and roll punk rock clothing company in the world. And I had my girlfriend, who's now my wife. You know what I mean? It was like, take 6 weeks off to go to Europe and not make any money. And like,
didn't make sense.
You know? Yeah. So they were like, well, we're going to do it. If we're not going to do it, we're going to replace you. So that was the big, like, well, fuck you. And they were like, well, fuck you. And fuck you. You know? But it didn't last too long. And that's also where I went off and did Cold Brew Rebels. I started Cold Brew Rebels with Danny Dangerous, Joe Normal from the Zeros, Purple Haired Zeros, and then Spaz Drastic on drums from the Glamour Punks. And we've started this super cool horror psychobilly punk band, Cold Brew Rebels. And we put out a bunch of amazing music. In fact, if you go on YouTube and search Cold Brew Rebels, you'll see tour footage. There's so much, like, it was one of the funnest things I've ever done because it was theatrical.
It's good stuff. I was checking it out.
Good stuff. Yep. And we toured a lot. We did a bunch of tours with Wednesday 13, who's on the tour on the road currently with doing Murder Dolls stuff. And we toured probably across the U.S. and into Canada probably 5 or 6 times in 4 or 5 years. So,
and that's not go. You don't have that together now at all, do you?
No, I want to. I would love to.
Why don't you? What's stopping you?
You know, Joe Normal's kind of got his own music career going. We kind of really, if I did it, I would want to have him on board. And I just, you know, right now with my kids and stuff, like I work, I have a great career working for Don Juan Grooming Products. You know, I travel, I do barber expos and hair shows and stuff like that. And I've got, you know, young kids, and we moved to Vegas 3 years ago, so I got a big house, and just, you know, kind of like, do I really want to like go on the road and, you know, make myself overly busy? Jet Boy, hopefully we're going to get a little busier next year. We actually just booked our first show February 10th in San Jose with Junkyard. I'm super excited about that because I love to play with the Junkyard guys. Our buddies, our old buddies from way back.
Have you played with them before?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Back in the day, of course, we did. And even in the last few years, we've played with them a few times. So,
how busy are you looking to get with Jet Boy?
What's that?
How busy are you looking to be with Jet Boy? Are you going to...
You know, I can't handle too busy. Mm-hmm. But I know that we have to stay busy enough to get the good offers. The Rock Timber Festival was freaking amazing. Like, I had a great time at that show. Rock Island Festival in Key West, Florida. That was probably those two were my favorite two shows of the year. So, you know, I'd like to get more on more of the festivals, the cruises and stuff like that for me. You know, it's a little bit more worthwhile, but I hope to get a little busier in 2024 than 2023 was.
Seems like
we do have a new record coming out.
Oh, you do?
It's our first ever covers record. So it's 13 songs, I think. 13 songs. They're a very eclectic blend of 70s, 80s, 90s. Kind of pop music. Like, we do a version of Dreamweaver by Gary Wright.
Four are out right now.
Yeah, so 4 singles have been released, but there's actually 13 songs on the record, so there's some great stuff on there. And I'm looking forward to that. It should be out, I think, in December. So
okay. I was surprised. The 4 that I saw, I was like, wow, that's an interesting choice, especially the Louis Capaldi song.
Oh, yeah. Well, that one was a song that my son discovered Louis Capaldi when he first learned how to use an iPad and was looking through YouTube videos. And we just saw him one day watching this video and singing along. And we're like, what? We're like, who is that? You know, and then we tuned into him, and then it's kind of a family favorite for us. Right. I love
him. He's fantastic.
Songwriter and everything. And so that's the one new song that's on there. The rest of them are all old. It doesn't really fit in a way, but I was just like, you know, please let's do this song. And none of the guys in Jet Boy had knew who he was. And so they kind of became instant fans. And I'm thankful we were able to do it, because it just does a lot of meaning for me. You know, it'll be, you know, yeah, as my son gets older, to know that, you know, I did that song for him and he turned me on to that artist.
Yeah,
you know,
that's fantastic. And it sounds good too. I mean, yeah, you did a great job on it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, all the tracks, like when we went into it, I mean, Brian Pereira from Cleopatra picked a lot of the tracks. We picked a few as well. But like, I really had no idea how, like, what kind of treatment we were going to give the songs. And when you listen to the record, you're like, wow, it's a style. You know what I mean? It's like there's a kind of a certain treatment and style that is pretty consistent through most of the songs. And it just kind of came together real magically. Our new lead guitar player, Jimmy Romero, produced it and recorded it at his home studio here in Vegas, Vintage. What is it? Everything Vintage, State Vintage Studios. I'm sorry. you know, our preferred drummer, Al Serrato, who's been with us for a little over 10 years and played on all of our, releases. He played on Born to Fly. He plays drums. He doesn't get to gig with us that much anymore because he's busy with other projects, but, his drumming is always phenomenal. And, Scott Richards on bass, Billy Rowe on guitar, although Billy doesn't get to play with us these days that much because he's on tour with Buck Cherry almost consistently. We have Keith in the band now, and he's the new Billy. He's another phenomenal musician. He didn't play on the record, but he's been doing gigs with us. So we've got a great new lineup.
Is Billy still playing with you when he can?
When he can.
Okay.
When he can, absolutely. And he's, you know, involved in all the business and everything. It's pretty much him and I are the last two original members. Fern has retired and we don't really have too much contact. So yeah, me and Billy are keeping the flame burning. Mm-hmm.
Were you two the main songwriters in the band?
You know, I think it's
there too.
Yeah, no, it was all of us, and definitely Sammy Yaffa for Damnation.
Okay.
Especially was a key songwriter. Born to Fly, Billy and I wrote most of it, and Fern wrote some stuff as well. But Born to Fly really was me and Billy clicking on, like, you know, the whole record is like mid-tempo, catchy, poppy rockers, which is kind of our forte, you know.
Yeah, I always thought you guys were interesting to me because you didn't have the real glammed outlook. You had your mohawk, but you guys didn't look like, say, Poison. Yeah. But you had that catchy, poppy sound.
I feel like the LA scene in the beginning, right, they were still kind of more like store-bought glam, right? Mm-hmm. Like they were going to, you know, buying women's clothes at, you know, alternative stores and stuff. And we were way more on the like thrift store, like cut your pants, like stitching fringe on our pants and like making stuff. And even like with the punk influence, with like the creepers and the bolo ties, and like there were certain elements that weren't really happening in LA. Mm-hmm. and until we came down, and it's like by the time Poison's first record came out, they were like wearing creepers and stuff, right? Like, I'm not saying we like invented it or whatever. I mean, obviously it's been popular in, you know, with punk bands and whatnot, but there was definitely a difference in the style between the glam scene of San Francisco and what was going on in LA.
Yeah.
And they kind of blended together, but yeah, I think it, you know, for us, it was like, it was the shock aspect of it. We were way more like New York Dolls, where it's like, you know, and then it was, there was the other side was kind of like, you know, I don't know. It was like pretty boy rock, tours, we were like, oh no, like I want to look like a fucking horrible drag queen on a bad night. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, they were like, you know, the LA scene was more like, you know, pretty boy, like, you know.
Yeah, but you guys still had that sound a little bit. Like yeah. I could see Poison doing some of your songs. You know, you
yeah,
know
for what sure. I'm saying? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it was that, you know, poppy party rock, you know what I mean? Party rock that wasn't like overly masculine, you know, a little bit girly and, you know, poppy and boppy and whatever, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was saying earlier about those other songs, the unreleased songs, some of those seem like a little grittier.
Yeah, for sure.
We ended up on the album.
We've always had that in us. But I think, you know, as we became, you know, after our first album and we became actual, like, you know, we're recording artists, like we're touring, like we're actually professionals. We're not just like some gutter punk, you know what I mean? And so I think then we allowed our roots to come through more because we all grew up on AC/DC and Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and like a lot of heavy stuff. Before we got turned on to New York Dolls and How I Rocks and you know, stuff like that. So, and even Kiss, right? So I think, as we developed, we kind of just let that infiltrate and, you know, the AC/DC sound is heavy in there. The Aerosmith classic rock sound is in there. And then a little bit of that, you know, like, because we're all metalheads at heart too, you know what I mean? Like, I was going to see Dio and Iron Maiden and all these bands before I got in Jet Boy. So it's like, why not? You know, now it seems like everybody's way more open-minded. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah I agree.
You know what I mean? It's like, you see people wear t-shirts or like, whatever. You're like a heavy metal guy's wearing a country singer and a country guys wearing a freaking, you know, ska band shirt or whatever, you know what I mean? So I think it's more accepted now to kind of have a wide variety of musical taste.
Well, now people wear shirts they don't even know who the band is.
Yeah, right. but some do, right? Yeah. Some are like 1 minute listening to Metallica and the next minute listening to, you know, whatever. So yeah. I just think, you know.
How about any new original material? You going to do any new records with original material?
Of course. I'll say yes, because you know, as long as we keep doing what we're doing, that would be the next logical step for me now that we kind of have, you know, especially Jimmy, our lead guitar player, who's an amazing singer and musician and producer and, you know, guitar player and everything. Why not? You know, it's just a matter of kind of carving out the time and. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because momentum's picked up in the genre, the rock genre.
Yeah,
you know, with all these festivals and everything going on, and
yeah, you know, we also are talking about putting together like a proper documentary too. Mm-hmm. We did the glam years for Cleopatra like in the early 2000s, but it was kind of just like a one-off interview and you know old footage or whatnot. But we'd really like to get a little more elaborate and do like a proper documentary with interviews with people we've worked with over the years and other musicians and a little more detailed with our story and stuff like that. So that's
awesome.
Yeah
I'd love to see stuff like that.
Yeah
Good man, sounds like everything's going pretty good for you right now.
Yeah, I'm overworked, but you know.
Yeah, I guess that's the trend though these days. I think we're all there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here in Vegas now. I've got a beautiful house with a pool, you know, like, I mean, for me, sometimes I'm just like the fact that like, I'm a homeowner and like, I have a job and a wife and kids and like, you know, just like things that are nothing, you know, rock starry or amazing, but just that's like me, like I never thought I would own anything, much less a house, you know what I mean? Yeah. So
and sometimes I really have.
Yeah, and still being able to do it. I'd like to be able to do it more, but, you know, every time I get up there and do it, it's a reminder of why we keep doing it. So
yeah,
and why we literally can't stop doing it, right?
Yeah, so, well, yeah. I think once you get bit by that bug, as they say, you don't you can't stop, you know, it's too hard. Yeah. Like even me, I don't do touring and stuff like you do, but I'm still recording and
yeah, you got to have the outlet.
You're still doing stuff.
Got to have the musical outlet.
That's awesome, man. All right, Mickey, I appreciate you taking the time, bud.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to go get my kids in the bath and into bed.
Hopefully they didn't tear the house down out there.
Yeah, I know.
All right, buddy.
All right, my bro. Keep it real.